Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Global Health Forum Blog Talk Radio. This show is a public service of People to People, a not-for-profit 501c3 registered Ethiopian diaspora healthcare organization. I'm your host, Dr. Antan Hapte, Chairman of People to People's Board of Directors. This evening we'll be discussing about health systems and the health and development agenda in sub-Saharan Africa. The African population is in the midst of a health transition characterized by the simultaneous occurrence of epidemic infectious diseases and a rise in non-communicable diseases. There's direct interaction between infectious risk factors and chronic diseases such as human papillomavirus and cervical cancer, streptococcus pyogenes and rheumatic heart disease, pulmonary tuberculosis and chronic lung disease, trachoma and blindness, HIV and dementia, etc. So as the population increases and the demand on the health system grows, the gap is becoming increasingly apparent. 2015 is the target date for the 8 Millennium Development Goals set by the United Nations in 2000, ranging from cutting extreme poverty rate by half to halting the spread of HIV/AIDS and providing universal primary education. So what does the scoreboard look like as we complete the first quarter of the final year? What are the lessons learned from the recent Ebola outbreak on Africa's health system? We'll be discussing these issues and more with my guest for this evening, Dr. Sanaith Kabeda, who is a pediatrician active in the global health arena. She's a graduate of Addis Ababa University Medical School and holds a master's degree in public health from the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Sanaith has extensive experience in clinical practice and academia and works with many international organizations in global health, including the World Health Organization. She's an adjunct faculty at Emory University's Department of Global Health in Atlanta and an honorary associate professor of pediatrics at the Millennium Medical College in Ethiopia. So delighted to have you on the Global Health this night. So if you could start us off by briefly describing your professional background and experience in your recent or ongoing projects pertaining to child health in Africa.
Thank you, Dr. Antenna. My background, as you have already alluded to, is basically I am an MD and pediatrician with a master's of public health. So I blend my clinical experience with a public health practice and currently working mainly in international organizations providing technical assistance and being engaged in various assignments, including consultative meetings to develop global level and regional level recommendations and guidelines and tools, especially focusing on HIV/AIDS, child survival, maternal and child health strategies, and epidemics like the pandemic influenza, seasonal influenza, and at a time when other epidemics are considered for global and regional level recommendations. I have been part of some of the consultative meetings. So my role mainly has been working with international organizations in these areas, but the most recent one had been on HIV/AIDS, working with UNAIDS, developing the investment case for HIV, which uses mathematical modeling to show where investments should be focused based on different scenarios and showing the results of the return on investments and trying to support countries how best to align resources and allocate resources. After doing that recently, I just finished that work and I have also been taking part in the teaching activities at Millennium Medical College, where I do deliver lectures and make clinical rounds, as well as working with the team to start a research project, which will soon commence on TB-HIV with intensive case finding using the MCH approach. So briefly, academics, clinical practice, and public health interventions and public health practice is what I'm doing. So most of the time, my work is in a consultancy, a short-term engagement, which means I have various clients working with WHO, UNICEF, UNAIDS. Sometimes I have also worked with the CDC and USAID and the World Bank in different capacities.
So you started out working as a clinician, as a pediatrician, of course, for a long time. And what prompted your interest in public health?
My interest in public health was actually prompted when I was in the pediatrics department as a teaching staff. And this was basically looking at my department head then, Dr. Hagos Bayene, who has passed away a few years back. The approach he has been using and the way he was handling the pediatric cases and also the teaching practice that he had coming from him was really showing us a different way of looking at our management style. So I used to say what is different in terms of the way he's addressing the health determinants. It was not only a focus on clinical condition or treatment or diagnosis, but he was looking at a patient as a holistic, with a holistic approach, trying to understand what brought the condition, how the family and household practice is influencing the prognosis and the treatment outcomes. And also going further to see the social aspect beyond the household and the community patterns and practices that may influence the disease patterns that are, that brought the children in the hospital. So it was a very eye-opening experience working with him, and I did see that his approach was different, not only clinical, but taking into consideration the different dimensions and determinants of health while treating patients to ensure a lasting response in the way he was managing the patients that are under our care. So based on his practice, I was impressed, and I did say I need to do public health, and soon I was engaged in a public health related research work, which was a multi-country research through WHO. Ethiopia was one of the countries that was doing the basic research that really formed the foundation for the integrated management of childhood illnesses, and I was privileged to be one of the investigators in the research site, which really broadened my horizon in terms of understanding the public health dimension and the public health practice. And later on, I did join Johns Hopkins University and studied international health concentration and finished my master's in public health. And also my being engaged in a work with the World Health Organization initially as a consultant, but later on as a staff member, and providing technical assistance and using public health approach to improve health interventions for children, and the scope of my work subsequently expanding to be a coordinator of the 3x5, the Zain WHO initiative to reach 3 million people to put on ART by 2005, and I was coordinating that effort at the Regional Office for Africa. And later on also I became the pediatrics focal person for pediatrics HIV in the region. And it went on from that, and I did have opportunities to be engaged in other endeavors that were really sharpened the skill and also provided me the opportunity to gain more experience traveling across the countries and working at the headquarters to determine some of the outcomes of the studies and looking at the recommendations and how best to put forward some of the guidelines that are helpful for developing countries, recognizing the circumstances of resource limitation and other constraints.
Great. You mentioned integrated management of childhood illnesses. Could you explain to our audience what exactly that means?
Approach was developed to see how best we can focus on the most common conditions that affect child health. When we look at child mortality and morbidity, particularly in the developing countries, of which Africa is one, and 70% of deaths are from common illnesses such as pneumonia, diarrhea, malaria, measles, and in 45% of the cases, these is accompanied by malnutrition, which really worsens the situation. So the integrated management of childhood illnesses is a set of signs and symptoms that can be taught to health workers across the board, but basically at the primary level. It also has a component of community practices that can be promoted and taught at the community level to improve maternal health care-seeking behavior, and also making sure that some of the home managements are also practiced at the household level. So this guideline, it has a set of guidelines, teaching materials, monitoring materials, and follow-up materials, which was developed by national experts. And this training has been helpful to see how best children are captured at the primary level and also be provided with the most important primary medication. It may be a shot of antibiotics and then urgent referral to the hospital, or some of them may be managed at the outpatient level. So this algorithm and a management approach where you can delineate those who need urgent referral, those who need treatment at the household level, at an outpatient level, has been very useful in trying to triage the patients for appropriate care as soon as possible and providing them interventions that are affordable and that can be provided within the reach of the community. So it's based on several studies. These signs and symptoms are selected on based on the not trained so many health workers with this approach, and that has improved the level of care at the primary level. But you have to train also higher level health workers, including pediatricians, so that one can be sure that you have a massive number of people who are aware of the strategy to support it, to provide direction and technical leadership, as well as making sure that referrals are understood by the different cascade of level of care that is required for management of these children.
All right, thank you. I alluded to the Millennium Development Goal at the beginning of our segment. These are the 8 goals set by the United Nations Development Project for development, and with the target date being 2015, the end of 2015. And now we hear also the description of the health and development agenda in Africa. Are these two the same or are they different?
The Millennium Development Goals have a target of 2015, and they will end then. But most of the countries, though there has been significant progress made with the Millennium Development Goals, those 8 goals that have been specified, the progress is uneven. The results are mixed. Some countries have progressed in some of the dimensions, like, for example, Millennium Development Goal 4, reducing child deaths by two-thirds by 2015. Some countries have been able to achieve that, while some are still struggling to achieve this goal. So there are exemplary countries that have been able to achieve some of the Millennium Development Goals, while others are still on the way. But all in all, there is good progress. And the Millennium Development Goal has kind of galvanized support and also gave an impetus to look forward to a certain defined goal for countries through which they can channel their efforts to achieve those goals. And in that regard, it has been a very important endeavor for many countries, and particularly for developing countries. So in Africa, still the goal is the same. Now, moving on from Millennium Development Goal, the next strategy is the Sustainable Development Goals. This is a little bit different. They are actually developed in parallel, but when you look at the Millennium Development Goal, it has 8 set objectives and goals, whereas the Sustainable Development Agenda has around 17 goals. And one of the differences is that the Millennium Development Goals are pertaining mainly to developing countries per se, while the Sustainable Development Goals are supposed to be applied for developing as well as developed countries. And the other dimension that is brought on board with the Sustainable Development Goal is the issue of equity, issue of protection, and also environment. And so they are more expanded when we are looking at the agenda that we are going to see forward. And Africa is part of that, and Africa is will be looking at also these goals moving forward from Millennium Development Goals to Sustainable Development Goals. The negotiation is still going on, but still there are 17 major goals to be targeted by 2013. So it is broader in scope. At social, the issue of equity and environmental protection and environmental interventions, climate change, become very important when we look at the Sustainable Development Goals. But the unfinished agenda of the Millennium Development Goals is believed to continue, and I'm sure countries will be looking at how best to tackle and how best to galvanize their efforts to still to achieve unachieved goals, like the maternal mortality ratio. It has been dropping, but countries have not achieved the goal for 2015, and countries will continue their efforts. And particularly in Africa, the health system is a very serious issue that needs to be addressed.
Right, right. Certainly some of the goals are better met than others. As you mentioned, with the Millennium Development Goal 4, countries like Ethiopia have made tremendous progress, you know, dropped their child under 5 child mortality rate very dramatically. But there are some other goals which are a little maybe more difficult to achieve. As I said, I want to mention Millennium Development Goal 8, which sets out to develop a global partnership for development. So what do you think of the current paradigm of aid and development, both in the health and other sectors, and how do you maintain the balance between country ownership and global partnership?
I think that is, again, the biggest issue when we talk about the partnership. This is a very controversial issue when we look at from the perspective of aid effectiveness or developmental aid that is coming to developing countries. There has been a lot of debate, a lot of negotiation, and paradigm shifts have been tried in many spheres. And the Paris Declaration actually emphasizes the need for country ownership in the aid and in the partnership arena. But have we achieved that when we look at recipient countries, particularly in the African context? We can still be questioning whether these ratifications and declarations have been made practical, and they haven't yet been practical, though progress may have been seen here and there. So when we look at the partnership or the aid effectiveness, one thing is there is work to be done from both the donor side as well as from the recipient side. Donors, from the donor side, the caveat and the drawbacks that we see is that there are strings attached most of the time because of probably lack of accountability or in quotation or fear of accountability. There is a tendency to provide the funding or to channel the funding through NGOs from donor countries. Again, one may question whether those NGOs are the right channels or the right structures to interpret the country priority and to implement the country priority to the satisfaction and to the achievement of the goal ahead. It's not always the case, because what we see is proliferation of so many NGOs, and which has made it difficult at national level to keep track of the impact and also the output and outcome from these NGO interventions. There are so many views. There are extreme views which do say that aid is not important for Africa and we should move away from aid. And others would say it has its value, but the way we are doing it needs to change, the way we function, the way we align priorities, the way the funding mechanism, the implementation structures and the implementation mechanisms and accountability needs to be improved. So it is a continuous debate, but one can say for sure that national ownership is a very critical element. And I think more than ever, we do have in Africa well-educated, well-trained civil servants. And I think it's time to see how this can be translated to taking the ownership and showing the impact in leading these processes. And we should be mindful that the aid landscape is changing. There may be, and I think we have seen in many countries that there will be dwindling of aid resources to African countries because of the economic climate, because of the recession. So it has time for national governments to step up and see how the priorities in the health sector and other dimensions are sustainably financed from the national resources. So partnership is important. There are technical partnerships, there are financial support that come to countries, but how do we harness these support to benefit the communities, the individuals, and also the national governments that are recipients of this aid? I think we have a long way to go. So far, we can say that we haven't been really very successful to the satisfaction of the goal that was intended to be really probably genuine in providing this technical and financial support. I think if we look at how much money has been allocated or has been pledged for some of the important interventions, I can say that we haven't achieved as much as we could have with that amount of resources. And I think this is shared by so many researchers and so many authorities in the field who have documented this fact. So I think African countries need to be really prepared in the next sustainable development goals strategies, how best to allocate national resources, how best to make national revenues be aligned with the national priorities in a sustainable manner, and also examine the relationship with partners, how best this partnership is going to unfold in the real world to make sure that there is a win-win relationship, there is transparency, and the voices of the nationals who are really leaders in the field are heard, and the direction that the country is following is achieving the impact that is intended to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Although there may not be a consensus about, you know, the future formula for partnership, as you mentioned, almost everybody agrees that the impact of all the financial aid, you know, until now, has not really been as much as one would like. And when we talk about, you know, resource-limited countries, resource-constrained countries, one of the main resources we talk about is skilled manpower. And one of the ways that different countries try to combat that is by increasing the training of skilled manpower. Like in Ethiopia, the number of medical schools has increased dramatically over the last few years. And their effort to increase the pool of their skilled professionals there, you know, forging partnerships with various international institutions. So how do you think this relationship should be structured, you know, to create a mutually beneficial relationship, and what's your impression of what's been going on so far?
I know that there are several partnerships, and I'm not very much into I don't know some of the details, but I do know that there are partnerships. And as I said earlier, in any partnership, what is important is one has to see where the benefit, where the advantage is, and how best to negotiate to have an impact at the end of the day, a set of goals and indicators that will lead us towards that achievement. So the partnership is a critical component in empowering institutions achieve quality services delivered by well-trained professionals. I think that is what we are looking for. We would like to see well-trained professionals, competent professionals, that are really empowered to lead some of the processes. And having these professionals is going to be demonstrated in various ways. We will see what research outputs are coming out from these professionals. I think there are measuring yardsticks if our partnership is really working for us and is really benefiting us. And we have to be the voice in that partnership to see what needs to be done. Are we getting the advantage that we are looking for? If not, how can we negotiate for the things that we really are looking for and where the gap is? And that gap needs to be filled. That technical gap, that financial gap, that technology gap needs to be filled. And how do we align ourselves, and what is the responsibility from the national side, from our side, and then what is the partner added value from this relationship? I think we need to see that there is an active engagement of people who are well situated in terms of leading the academic agenda, making sure that the training component is looking at the quality of the trainees, the competency of the trainees, and also research is should be taken on board as a priority agenda, because any institution which is supposed to be academically vibrant will have a research component at the center, at the center of it all. So we have to see how we can harness what we are getting from this partnership and see whether that is really interpreted into action and products that would really demonstrate the usefulness and the direction of the partnership to where it's going to take us. I think that's one thing we need to really forge ahead and see if the partnership is achieving its goal by demonstrating the competency level of the trainees, as well as the research output, and also improved quality of services. I think these are major deliverables that we can see if we are taking advantage of these partnerships.
Staying with the medical education and training of physicians and other healthcare professionals, you're involved in that both in Ethiopia and here in the United States. What would you say are the similarities and differences in training the healthcare professionals of the future?
I think these are two different systems, so comparison may be difficult, but what we can see is what we learn from the different perspectives and context. I think in the U.S., where there is the education system is quite mature. We know that it's a long years of experience in the scientific arena with scientific advances and research, and great academic schools are available with many years of experience and stability in the teaching learning environment. The other thing we see is also probably it's because of the way the system works. Most schools may be a private. Competency and competitiveness is not something that we take for granted. It has to be there. So you can see that the students are really competitive, the schools are competitive, and competitiveness is what gets you where you want to go. So there is a lot of academic vibrancy in that regard. Our institutions are young. I see a lot of potential, and we do have people who are committed, leaders, and there is no doubt that there is a lot of potential. However, I think we need to see whether there is a good empowerment towards achieving that academic vibrancy that we need to see. There is still a lack of technology. There is still a lack of resources, whether it is books, computers, internet availability. All these are some of the constraints that make the learning teaching process a little bit challenging. Also, research, again, it may be a resource issue. It may be we don't have enough number of faculties. The system may not be conducive enough for people to do research. They may not have time. They may have overlapping responsibilities. So I think we need to look at what are the critical challenges that need to be addressed when we come to look at the academic institutions and to ensure that there is a robust academic institution. What are the empowering conditions that need to be that need to prevail? What can the government do? What are the institutions institutions themselves can be able to afford or put in place a system to make sure that there is academic accountability. Are we having the necessary instruments? Are we having the necessary monitoring mechanisms to make sure that we keep track of people who are doing research, who are publishing, people who are really committed and are dynamic in the teaching arena, and how do we develop the faculty? How can we support them? How can we facilitate situations to make sure that the learning teaching process is dynamic enough and vibrant enough to make to ensure quality training and competent physicians, competent graduates or postgraduate physicians that could be made available to improve the services in the country.
Okay, we've reached the halfway mark of our program, and I would like to remind our audience that you're listening to the Global Health Forum, Public Service by People to People. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Haptin. My guest this evening is Dr. Sanait Kabeda, a pediatrician and global health expert. She's an adjunct faculty at Emory University's Department of Global Health in Atlanta and an honorary associate professor of pediatrics at the Millennium Medical College in Ethiopia. Dr. Sanait brings a vast experience in global health and has worked with WHO in the integrated management of childhood illness as a medical officer for 10 Southern African countries. She serves as the focal person for pediatric HIV/AIDS in Africa in the initiative to improve access for antiretroviral treatment. We invite you to be an active participant of the show. You can ask your questions or share your comments by dialing 646-595-4742. Press 1 if you'd like to speak. You can also email your questions and comments to info@people.org. So I'm going to open up the forum. Before I go to the audience questions, though, Dr. Sanait, can you tell us a little bit about the International Health Consultancy Company you founded in 2004? What areas is your company active in?
Well, the consultancy firm is active in different dimension of particularly the training and the technical support to countries. So, for example, some of the things that we do is needs assessment, proposal or project development, planning, evaluation, and also disease surveillance. So we do have multinational network of consultants all over the world, and we can mobilize these resources to support some of the activities and some of the call for proposal that come our way from different agencies, particularly usually among UN agencies, for supporting countries to provide technical assistance in these areas. So it may be a training or a training material, or it may be a technical area in the form of developing strategic planning, implementation of some projects, and also evaluation and monitoring of projects.
All righty. I have a caller from area code 510. Go ahead, please. Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you, Dr. Sanait, for the discussion. My question is about my recent visit to Ethiopia, specifically in Addis Ababa, and I'm impressed with the cutting of the mortality rate and all that. But the one thing that bothered me was there's not enough playgrounds for the kids wherever you go. You know, even the new areas, they're building all these apartment buildings. There's no green areas for the kids to come out and play. Everything is about construction and development, but nothing about children exists around those areas. And how is that kind of problem addressed in the near future?
I think that's a very good question, and I think I share the concern that we don't seem to see green areas, in at least in Addis. There is a lot of construction going on, and there is hardly any green area in between the buildings or on the sideways, let alone for children to come up and play. And I think one of the issues that needs to be addressed, environmental protection, urbanization, and all these issues are also addressed in sustainable development goals. At least there are some indicators that for countries to follow when urbanization is taking place, social services and other sectors that are required to continue their role in the community need to be addressed in a proper. Of course, this needs to be taken on board. I'm not sure how it is addressed, but at least from the global perspective of sustainable development goals and also the African Union joining efforts in education and environment protection, this agenda that will be addressed. Hello?
All right. Hello?
Yes.
All right. Okay. Thank you, caller. I have an email question from another caller, Solomon from Phoenix, and asking about what lessons did Africa learn from the recent Ebola outbreak, which caught the continent flat-footed. It says, does the future healthcare agenda account for this kind of epidemics and plan on specific measures to strengthen the healthcare delivery system? Can you hang up, caller, please?
I think what we learn from the recent Ebola epidemic is how weak and fragile our health system is. And I think that's a sad reality. In most countries, the health system is weak and fragile. And such kind of occurrences could have been prevented if there was an early warning system to ensure that early cases are identified as soon as possible and dealt with before the epidemic spread. So there are a number of efforts ongoing. One of the things that is, at least from the African perspective, is this reality has created an urgency in terms of the establishment of the African CDC. There has been a meeting, and I think some of you might have already looked at some of the news that is coming out of this meeting. At least there is a plan to establish an African CDC in one of the locations as a central point, and the main priority will be early warning for such epidemics. And then there might be up to 8 regional offices or regional centers where such effort can be organized and function in such a way that there is a system to create information sharing before epidemic goes or widely spread. So I think when we talk about the health system, we are talking about at least the 6 pillars: the health workforce, the infrastructure, the health finance, and the supply chain, and also others. So one thing that we have seen is that in all dimensions, the health systems are weak. If we had enough human resources, if the infrastructure was good enough to tackle infection control, if the health financing was sustainable and properly allocated, and if we had enough resources, if the supply chain management was working well and we can get drugs delivered to the place where they are required, if infection control was really in place, then we wouldn't have seen this disasters and loss of lives that we have witnessed. So I think what we learned is our system is weak. We need to address this by working on all these six pillars. And it's not an option, but it looks as if we have to see how best we can expedite these processes of strengthening the health system in the region. And one of the things that has been advocated recently was integration of regions. So countries may really form partnership or among the same blocks. A number of countries may work together and share experiences or share resources and technical capacities that might be helpful to avert such kind of disasters in the future.
All right, thank you. I have another caller from area code 203623. Please go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yes. Okay, great. I'm glad I got through. Thank you for taking the call this evening. I just have a couple of general questions. Are strategies to moderate population growth part of the healthcare agenda in Africa? And do you believe this will require a deliberate effort by the government and healthcare advocates? Or do you expect this to be like a natural byproduct of improved education, access to healthcare, and or improved child mortality?
I think we need to see the list of the strategies. I think they are comprehensive. The problem is, how do you measure these efforts? But population growth and population monitoring is part of the strategy in different ways. So it's not only the child health mortality, it's the maternal mortality, it is the environmental protection, it is the availability of contraceptive, it is also other dimensions. I can go on and on. Because of time, I would not be able to exhaust the list. Even though there are 17 SDGs or Sustainable Development Goals, when we come to the health, there are a number of indicators, a number of subsections among below each major goals. So it is part of the agenda in Africa, and we need to see how best countries are positioning themselves to achieve this. So it is part of it, but there are different dimensions. There are different indicators. One of the things that the MDG was criticized for in some of the elements of the MDG goals was that there is no measure that will show the outcome or the impact for some of the goals. But I think with the refinement of the indicators, we do have some measures that can be adapted, and countries in the African region or individual countries can also take these guide and form indicators to make sure that the subsections from the health and population that needs to be there are really captured and monitored, and we can see what progress we are making in these different elements, population growth dynamics.
Well, I just wanted to add to that the 2014 statistics for Ethiopia shows a total fertility rate about 5.4 per woman, and the top 20 countries except for Afghanistan were all in sub-Saharan Africa. And it means that the rate's about 2 children per couple indicate population growth. So that, as you said, is something that may be addressed again with the new initiatives. I have another caller from 203. Please go ahead.
Paul, I want to make sure I let you know that I appreciate your show and the time that both the moderator and guests put in to help educate us about, you know, various health-related topics. So thank you. My question today is about the inadequate immunization coverage of children in Africa, which is probably one of the main drivers of mortality and morbidity. Now, how do you expect coverage to increase in the next decade or so? And secondarily, do you believe that the problem is due to the lack of vaccines, or are there social and cultural barriers about vaccination that need to be directly addressed?
This is one of the major issues that child health managers and Ministry of Health is struggling with. And for a time being, sometimes immunization coverage in a specific country or in a specific context may start to go well, but then it is not sustained. So we are still struggling in the African continent, making sure that we have the coverage that we need for immunization. But as you would expect, there are so many factors that are responsible for inadequate immunization coverage. Conflict areas are usually the most affected by this, and as we all know, there are so many countries still under conflict, and that has disrupted health services, and one of the services that suffer the brunt is also immunization. Lack of vaccine, it has not been a cause in most countries, but it depends on what the mechanism for the vaccination or the vaccine is in different countries. In some countries, the vaccination is usually through UNICEF partner agencies. The UN agencies are providing the vaccine. In those instances, the vaccine may not be short. But if you have difficult terrain, if the logistics is not appropriately outlined, and if there are social and cultural factors that create a barrier for vaccination, then even if you have the vaccine, then you may not reach the populations that need to be reached and that need to receive the vaccine on time and appropriately. So just as the as I said, that there is weak and fragile health, so every dimension of the health pillar plays a role even in vaccination. So if you don't have enough manpower to deploy for vaccination, again, that might also be one challenge for increasing the coverage. So there are national immunization days. There are so many strategies that have come into play to boost immunization coverage. So usually there is a strategy that is being implemented, and this may differ by country. And we may have to see what innovative ways need to be adopted to make sure that immunization coverage is maintained and sustained in Africa.
Okay. So we're fast running out of time, but I want to ask you about, you know, diaspora professional participation in their countries of origin. As you well know, P2P works diligently to mobilize diaspora professionals in all aspects of healthcare in Ethiopia. So what do you think the role of the diaspora should be, both as individuals and representing their institutions?
Well, I think the role of diaspora is, again, to see how we can bridge the gap. There is an experience and a different set of skills that the diaspora may be able to bring. And that is one role that the diaspora can play, either through volunteerism or through organized intentional efforts to promote and support teaching and training in the country, providing services, organizing investment opportunities in the health field, and also research collaboration are some of the areas that I can think of that can be of benefit in Ethiopia. So there are multiple opportunities and avenues for the diaspora to be engaged. Even if some of the things that the diaspora is doing may may have a shape and a structure that will enable for bigger interventions. But I think at an individual level, a humble and small contribution may also play its role, because the more people do that, I think the collective effort will amount to a substantial input when we add the efforts together. So there are multiple opportunities where we can share our experiences, provide our time and effort, and also volunteer and create collaboration, create the link so that we can be able to support the efforts at national level.
All right, Issa, to wrap up, any final thoughts or messages to our audience?
You want me to wrap up? Sorry.
Yeah, yes, please, if you.
Yes,
final thoughts.
My final thoughts are, I just want to reflect that Africa is being mentioned as the one which is always behind when it comes to any development goals, and looking at the health, I think we are still far away in terms of reaching where we need to be. And we have to look inside ourselves in terms of finding the solution. There has been a lot when we talked about aid effectiveness. I think a lot has been done, and I think one has to see that the final push has to come from ourselves and from inside. And we have to see whether we are placing our efforts enough and recognizing that there has been a lot of progress in terms of trained professionals. We have a lot of trained professionals more than ever, and we can use this energy to benefit the continent. And our voices need to be heard. I think those are the messages I would like to leave, that there are professionals, we do have talent, there are opportunities for Africans to get their voices heard, and we need to make that happen if we want to see Africa move forward in terms of improving the health system and strengthening the health system. There is a solution, but it has to come from us. If we are expecting that donors or partners will do it, it's not going to work. So we need to realize what we have. We need to harness the potential within us to see how we can come together to address the health challenges, and also see how we can have a concerted effort to address the health challenges and the health system challenges, and make the continent a better place to produce healthy children and healthy individuals that will play their role in making development a reality in Africa.
Okay, this brings us to the conclusion of our program. Those of you who did not get the opportunity to ask your questions on the air, please email them to info@peoplepeople.org, and I can forward them to Dr. Sennait. I would like to thank my guests for this evening, Dr. Sennait Kabeda, adjunct faculty at Emory University Department of Global Health in Atlanta, and an honorary associate professor of pediatrics at the Millennium Medical College in Ethiopia, with an insightful discussion on the healthcare challenges in Africa. Dr. Sennait is also the founder of International Health Consultancy, an Atlanta-based company that provides consulting services to local and international organizations. Thank you very much, Dr. Sennait.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you, the audience, for tuning in to the Global Health Forum, and we invite you to join us every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. As always, you can help shape our program by submitting your comments and suggestions through info@peoplepeople.org or People to People's Facebook page. If you're unable to tune in live, you can access the archived show using the link on the People to People website. Brief program note, next Thursday, April 9th, Dr. Tsinsay Warata will be hosting Drs. Patricia Gordon and Jennifer Lang
of Cure Cervical Cancer. It is an organization dedicated to the early detection and prevention of cervical cancer around the globe. They will discuss the See and Treat technique, deemed the gold standard by WHO for the prevention and cure of cervical cancer in resource-constrained countries. The two physicians and their team will be heading out to Ethiopia later this month, where they plan to screen and treat 600 women and train local healthcare providers. So be sure to tune in to learn about their amazing work around the globe. And on April 16th, Dr. Lydia Kaswa will be hosting Ms. Ati Worku, who is a former Miss Ethiopia and founder of SIDS of Africa Foundation. You will learn about the amazing work she's doing in promoting child education and organizing community development programs to provide literacy and healthcare education. Find out how you can be part of the solution. Please check our website for more details on upcoming topics and guests. I'm your host, Dr. Anton Hapti, and I'll be back with you the first Thursday of next month for another segment of the Global Health Forum. Thank you for your support and stay engaged.